shuffle. They're doing the South Side shuffle. They're doing the South Side shuffle.
Genocide says something, not only about Israel, but about us, about Western civilization, about who we are as a people, where we come from, and what defines us. It says that all our vaunted morality and respect for human rights is a lie. It says that people of color, especially when they are poor and vulnerable, do not count. It says we will ensure global domination through racialized violence.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on what the genocide says about us. The Iran-Israel attacks and the prospects of a wider Middle East war have dominated the news. Meanwhile, the bloodbath in Gaza continues. Genocide is the crime of crimes. We're witnessing it in real time in Gaza. The UN says, quote, "The entire population of Gaza is enduring destruction at a scale and speed without parallel in recent history." Nothing, the UN said, can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's promised mighty vengeance quickly became genocide. As Chris Hedges points out, racism enables genocide. He says, "Arabs, like all those with darker skins, are worth less in this moral calculus." This explains the outrage over the murder of 7 employees from the World Central Kitchen and the silence over the killing of over 175 UN Palestinian aid workers. Those who remain silent in the face of genocide are complicit. Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning independent journalist who has covered the Middle East for many years. He's the host of the Chris Hedges Report and the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. He spoke in Newark, California in early April 2024.
There are no surprises in Gaza. Every horrifying act of Israel's genocide has been telegraphed in advance. It has been for decades. The dispossession of Palestinians of their land is the beating heart of Israel's settler colonial project. This dispossession has had dramatic historical moments, 1948 and 1967, when huge parts of historic Palestine were seized and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. Dispossession has also occurred in increments, the slow motion theft of land and steady ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. The incursion on October 7th into Israel by Hamas and other resistance groups, which left 1,154 Israelis, tourists, migrant workers dead, and saw about 240 people taken hostage, gave Israel the pretext for what it has long craved, the total erasure of Palestinians. Israel has raised 77% of healthcare facilities in Gaza, 68% of telecommunications infrastructure, nearly all municipal and governmental buildings, commercial, industrial, and agricultural centers, almost half of all roads, over 60% of Gaza's 439,000 homes, 68% of residential buildings, including the bombing of Al-Taj Tower in Gaza City on October 25th that killed 101 people, including 44 children and 37 women, and injured hundreds, and has obliterated refugee camps. The attack alone on the Jabalia refugee camp on October 25th killed at least 126 civilians, including 69 children, and injured 280. Israel has damaged or destroyed Gaza's universities, all of which are now closed, and 60% of other educational facilities, including 13 libraries. It has also destroyed at least 195 heritage sites, including 208 mosques, churches, and Gaza's central archives that held over 150 years of historical records and documents. Israel's warplanes, missiles, drones, tanks, artillery shells, and naval guns daily pulverize Gaza, which is only 20 miles long and 5 miles wide, in a scorched earth campaign unlike anything seen since the war in Vietnam. It has dropped 250,000 tons of explosives, that's the equivalent of two nuclear bombs, on Gaza. Many targets selected by artificial intelligence. It drops unguided munitions known as dumb bombs and 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs on refugee camps and densely packed urban centers, as well as the so-called safe zones. 42% of Palestinians killed have been in these safe zones, where they were instructed to flee. Over 1.7 million Palestinians have been displaced from their homes, forced to find refuge in overcrowded UNRWA shelters, hospital corridors and courtyards, schools, tents, or in the open air in southern Gaza, often living next to fetid pools of raw sewage. Israel's killed at least 32,705 Palestinians in Gaza, including over 13,000 children and 9,000 women. This means Israel is slaughtering as many as 187 people a day, including 75 children. It has killed 136 journalists, many, if not most of them, deliberately targeted. It has killed 340 doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers, 4% of Gaza's healthcare personnel. These numbers do not begin to reflect the actual death toll, since only those dead registered in morgues and hospitals, most of which no longer function, are counted. The death toll when those who are missing are counted is well over 40,000, and 70% are women and children. Doctors are forced to amputate limbs without anesthetic. Those with severe medical conditions, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, have died from lack of treatment or will die soon. Over 100 women give birth every day with little to no medical care. Miscarriages are up by 300%. Over 90% of the Palestinians in Gaza suffer from severe food insecurity, with people eating animal feed and grass. Children are dying of starvation. Palestinian writers, academics, scientists, and their family members have been tracked and assassinated. Over 75,000 Palestinians have been wounded, many of whom will be crippled for life. Israel plays linguistic tricks to claim there are no civilians in Gaza and deny every building, including mosques, hospitals, and schools, protected status. All Palestinians are branded as responsible for the attack on October 7th or written off as human shields for Hamas. All structures are considered legitimate targets because they are allegedly Hamas command centers or harbor Hamas fighters. These accusations, Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestine territory occupied since 1967, writes, are a pretext used to justify, these are her words, the killing of civilians under a cloak of purported legality, whose all-enveloping pervasiveness admits only of genocidal intent. We have never seen an assault on the Palestinians of this magnitude. But every atrocity, the killing of civilians, dispossession of land, arbitrary detention, torture, disappearances, closures imposed on Palestinian towns and villages, house demolitions, revoking residence permits, deportation, destruction of the infrastructure that maintains civil society, military occupation, dehumanizing language, theft of natural resources, especially aquifers, have long defined Israel's campaign to remove Palestinians from historic Palestine. The occupation and genocide would not be possible without the U.S., which gives Israel $3.8 billion a year in military assistance and is now sending another $2.5 billion in bombs, including 1,800 MK-84 2,000-pound bombs, 500 MK-82 500-pound bombs, and fighter jets to Israel. This is not only Israel's genocide, it is ours. The mass killing in Gaza is the culmination of a process. It is not an act. It is the predictable denouement of Israel's settler colonial project. It is coded within the DNA of the Israeli apartheid state. It is where Israel had to end up. Understand this fact, and everything Israel does makes sense. The blockage of humanitarian aid, the sealing off of northern Gaza, the mass starvation, the obliteration of Gaza's infrastructure, the looming assault on Rafah, and the upsurge in violence and land seizures in the West Bank. Israel has allowed 15,413 trucks into Gaza during the past 6 months. Gaza needs five times that number. Israel allowed 2,874 trucks in February, a 44% reduction from the previous month. Israeli soldiers have also killed scores of Palestinians attempting to receive aid from trucks in more than two dozen incidents. These attacks include the killing of at least 21 Palestinians and the wounding of 150 on March 14th, when Israeli forces fired on thousands of people in Gaza City. The same area had been targeted by Israeli soldiers hours before. Israel's assault has caught Gaza's own aid workers and international agencies partners inside a practically uninhabitable environment of mass displacement and deprivation, where 75% of solid waste is now being dumped in random sites, 97% of groundwater made unfit for human use, and the Israeli state using starvation as a weapon of war, Oxfam states. There is no place in Gaza, Oxfam notes, that is safe amid the forcible and often multiple displacements of almost the entire population, which makes the principal distribution of aid unviable, including agencies' abilities to help repair vital public services at scale. Oxfam blasts Israel for its disproportionate and indiscriminate attacks on civilians and humanitarian assets, as well as solar, water, power, and sanitation plants, UN premises, hospitals, roads, and aid convoys and warehouses, even when these assets are supposedly deconflicted after their coordinates have been shared for protection. None of these Israeli tactics will be altered with the building of a temporary pier. In fact, given the pending assault on Rafah, where 1.2 million displaced Palestinians are crowded in tent cities or camped out in the open air, Israel's tactics are about to get worse. If the Arab world will not take the Palestinian refugees, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken proposed during his first round of visits after October 7th, the Palestinians could well be cast adrift on ships. It worked in Beirut in 1982 when some 8,500 Palestinian Liberation Organization members were sent by sea to Tunis or Tunisia, and another 2,500 ended up in other Arab states. Israel, for this reason, supports the temporary pier the Biden administration is building to ostensibly deliver food and aid to Gaza, food and aid whose distribution will be overseen by the Israeli military. You need drivers that don't exist, trucks that don't exist, feeding into a distribution system that doesn't exist. Jeremy Kneidek, a former senior aid official in the Biden administration and now president of the Refugees International Aid Advocacy Group, told The Guardian. The small shipments of seaborne aid, like the food packets that have been airdropped, will not alleviate the looming famine. They are not meant to. They are cynical pieces of theater used to mask the orchestrated mass starvation. Israel is creating a humanitarian crisis of such catastrophic proportions, with thousands of Palestinians killed by bombs, shells, missiles, bullets, starvation, and infectious diseases, that the only option will soon be death or deportation. The pier, perhaps, is where the last act in this gruesome genocidal campaign will be played out as Palestinians are herded by Israeli soldiers onto ships. Or perhaps Washington will be able to buy off the Egyptian government to expel Palestinians to the Sinai. Whatever the outcome, the Biden administration, without whom this genocide could not be carried out, will facilitate it. Zionist leaders are quite open about their goals. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant announced that Gaza would receive, quote, no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs Israel Katz said, humanitarian aid to Gaza, no electrical switch will be turned on, no water hydrant will be opened. Avi Dichter, the Minister of Agriculture, referred to Israel's military assault as the Gaza Nakba, referring, of course, to the catastrophe which between 1947 and 1949 drove 750,000 Palestinians from their land and saw thousands massacred by Zionist militias. Likud member of the Knesset, Revital Gottlieb, posted on her social media account, bring down buildings, bomb without distinction, flatten Gaza, without mercy. This time, there is no room for mercy. Not to be outdone, Minister of Heritage Amichai Eliyahu supported using nuclear weapons on Gaza as, quote, one of the possibilities. The message from the Israeli leadership is unequivocal. Annihilate the Palestinians, the same way we annihilated Native Americans. The Australians annihilated the First Nations peoples. The Germans annihilated the Herero in Namibia. The Turks annihilated the Armenians, and the Nazis annihilated Jews. The specifics are different. The process is the same. And we cannot plead ignorance. We know what happened to the Palestinians. We know what is happening to the Palestinians, and we know what will happen to the Palestinians. But it is easier to pretend. Pretend Israel will allow in humanitarian aid. Pretend there will be a ceasefire. Pretend Palestinians will return to their destroyed homes in Gaza. Pretend Gaza will be rebuilt. Pretend the Palestine Authority will administer Gaza. Pretend there will be a two-state solution. Pretend there is no genocide. The genocide says something, not only about Israel, but about us, about Western civilization, about who we are as a people, where we come from, and what defines us. It says that all our vaunted morality and respect for human rights is a lie. It says that people of color, especially when they are poor and vulnerable, do not count. It says that their hopes, dreams, dignity, and aspirations for freedom are worthless. It says we will ensure global domination through racialized violence. This lie that Western civilization is predicated on values such as respect for human rights and the rule of law is one the Palestinians and all those in the global South, as well as Native Americans and Black and Brown Americans, have known for centuries. But with the Gaza genocide live streamed, this lie is becoming very hard to sustain. We do not halt Israel genocide because we are Israel, infected with white supremacy and intoxicated by our domination of the globe's wealth and the power to obliterate others with our industrial weapons. Remember the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman telling Charlie Rose on the eve of the war in Iraq that American soldiers should go house to house from Basra to Baghdad and say, these are his words, to Iraqis, suck on this. And this is the real credo of the American empire. The world outside of the industrial fortresses in the global north is acutely aware that the fate of the Palestinians is their fate. As climate change imperils survival, as resources become scarce, as migration becomes an imperative for millions, as agricultural yields decline, as coastal areas are flooded, as droughts and wildfires proliferate, as states fail, as armed resistance movements rise to battle their oppressors along with their proxies, genocide will not be an anomaly. It will be the norm. The Earth's vulnerable and poor, those Frantz Fanon call the wretched of the Earth, will be the next Palestinians. Genocide always requires the active participation of educated professionals, physicians, scientists, engineers, military leaders, lawyers, clergy, university professors, who, as Robert J. Lifton points out, create not only the technology of genocide, but much of its ideological rationale, moral climate, and organizational process. A group of 100 Israeli doctors in November 2023 defended the bombing of hospitals in Gaza, claiming they were used as Hamas command centers, a charge Israel has been unable to verify. The deans of U.S. medical schools and leading medical organizations, especially the American Medical Association, have joined the ranks of universities, law schools, churches, and the media to turn their backs on the Palestinians. The AMA shut down a debate on a ceasefire resolution among its members and has called for medical neutrality, although there was no medical neutrality when it denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There is a cost to denouncing genocide, a cost they do not intend to pay. They fear being attacked. They fear destroying their careers. They fear losing funding. They fear a loss of status. They fear persecution. They fear social isolation. This fear makes them complicit. And what of those who do speak out? They are branded as anti-Semites and supporters of terrorism. George Washington University clinical psychology professor Laura Sheehy was pushed out of her job. The former head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, was denied a fellowship at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy because of his alleged, quote, anti-Israel bias. San Francisco professor Rabab Abdelhada was sued for supporting Palestinian rights. Medical students and faculty in Canada are being suspended or expelled if they publicly criticize Israel. Dr. Rupa Mara, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, called for a halt to the bombing of hospitals and the examination of the impact of Zionism as a racist ideology. This led to vitriolic attacks against her, attacks tacitly endorsed by the medical school where she works. She has been slandered as an anti-Semite and targeted by the Canary Mission, a Zionist organization that seeks to defame and destroy the careers of students and faculty that criticize Israel and defend Palestinian rights. She has had speaking engagements rescinded and received death threats. The danger is not only that the Israeli crimes are denounced. The danger, more importantly, is that the moral bankruptcy and the cowardice of our own institutions and politicians are exposed. Those who promote this genocide have no rational or humane arguments to offer the public, only character assassination and censorship. The dehumanization of Palestinians is lifted from this racist playbook, the playbook of all settler colonial projects, including our own. It is why the two ruling parties sustain Israel's occupation and genocide. Arabs, like all those with darker skins, are worth less in this moral calculus. This explains the outrage over the murder of 7 employees from Global Central Kitchen and the silence over the murder of over 175 staff from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Global Central Kitchen, unlike UNRWA, which has seen its U.S. funding cut, does not have the logistic capacity to provide the food needed to alleviate the famine. Israel and Washington's support for Global Central Kitchen is part of the campaign to destroy UNRWA. Several humanitarian aid groups in Gaza after the killings have suspended operations. This suspension advances Israel's goal of a complete blockage of food to starving Palestinians. Let me end tonight by speaking about Aaron Bushnell, who lit himself on fire in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., resulting in his death. He pitted divine violence against the radical evil we witness in Gaza. As an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force, he was part of the vast machinery that sustains the genocide in Gaza, no less morally culpable than the German soldiers, technocrats, engineers, scientists, and bureaucrats who oiled the apparatus of the Nazi Holocaust. This was a role he could no longer accept. "I will no longer be complicit in genocide," he said calmly in his video as he walked to the gate of the embassy. "I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest. But compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their coloners, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal." Young men and women sign up for the military for many reasons. But starting, bombing, and killing women and children is usually not amongst them. Shouldn't, in a just world, the U.S. fleet break the Israeli blockade of Gaza to provide food, shelter, and medicine? Shouldn't U.S. warplanes impose a no-fly zone over Gaza to halt the saturation bombing? Shouldn't Israel be issued an ultimatum to withdraw its forces from Gaza? Shouldn't the weapons shipments, billions, and military aid and intelligence provided to Israel be halted? Shouldn't those who commit genocide, as well as those who support genocide, be held accountable? These simple questions are the ones Bushnell's death forces us to confront. Many of us like to ask ourselves, he posted shortly before his suicide, what would I do if I was alive during slavery, or the Jim Crow South, or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide? The answer is, you're doing it right now. The coalition forces intervened in northern Iraq in 1991 to protect the Kurds following the first Gulf War. The suffering of the Kurds was extensive, but dwarfed by the genocide in Gaza. A no-fly zone for the Iraqi Air Force was imposed. The Iraqi military was pushed out of the northern Kurdish areas. Humanitarian aid saved Kurds from starvation, infectious diseases, and death from exposure. But that was another time, another war. Genocide is evil when it is carried out by our enemies. It is defended and sustained when carried out by our allies.
You're listening to Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Walter Benjamin, whose friends Fritz Heinle and Rika Seligson committed suicide in 1914 to protest German militarism in the First World War, in his essay, Critique of Violence, examines acts of violence undertaken by individuals who confront radical evil. Any act that defies radical evil breaks the law in the name of justice. It affirms the sovereignty and dignity of the individual. It condemns the coercive violence of the state. It entails a willingness to die. Benjamin called these extreme acts of resistance divine violence. Only for the sake of the hopeless ones have we been given hope, Benjamin writes. Bushnell's self-immolation won most social media posts and news organizations have heavily censored is the point. It is meant to be seen. Bushnell extinguished his life in the same way thousands of Palestinians, including children, have been extinguished. We could watch him burn to death. This is what it looks like. This is what happens to Palestinians because of us. The image of Bushnell's self-immolation, like that of the Buddhist monk in Vietnam in 1963, or Mohammed Bouazizi, a fruit seller in Tunisia in 2010, is a potent political message. It jolts the viewer out of somnolence. It forces the viewer to question assumptions. It begs the viewer to act. It is political theater or perhaps religious ritual in its most potent form. Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh said of self-immolation, "To express will by burning oneself, therefore, is not to commit an act of destruction, but to perform an act of construction, that is, to suffer and to die for the sake of one's people." If Bushnell was willing to die, repeatedly shouting out "Free Palestine" as he burned, then something must be terribly, terribly wrong. These individual self-sacrifices become rallying points for mass opposition they can ignite, as they did in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, and Syria, revolutionary upheavals. Bouzazi, who was incensed that local authorities had confiscated his sales and produce, did not intend to start a revolution. But the petty and humiliating injustices he endured under the corrupt Ben Ali regime resonated with an abused public. If he could die, they could take to the streets. These acts are sacrificial births. They presage something new. They are the complete rejection in its most dramatic form of conventions and the reigning systems of power. They are a complete rejection. They are designed to be horrific. They are meant to shock. Burning to death is one of the most dreaded ways to die. Self-immolation comes from the Latin stem, immolare, to sprinkle with salted flour when offering up a consecrated victim for sacrifice. Self-immolations like Bushnell's link the sacred and the profane through the medium of sacrificial death. But to go to this extreme requires what the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr calls a sublime madness of the soul. He notes that nothing but such madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This madness is dangerous, but it is necessary when confronting radical evil, because without it, truth is obscured. Liberalism, Niebuhr warns, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. This extreme protest, this sublime madness, has been a potent weapon in the hands of the oppressed throughout history. The some 160 self-immolations in Tibet since 2009 to protest Chinese occupation are perceived as religious rites, acts that declare the independence of the victims from the control of the state. Self-immolation calls us to a different way of being. These sacrificial victims become martyrs. Communities of resistance, even if they are secular, are bound together by the sacrifices of martyrs. Only apostates betray their memory. The martyr, through his or her example of self-sacrifice, weakens and severs the bonds and the coercive power of the state. The martyr represents a total rejection of the status quo. This is why all states seek to discredit the martyr or turn the martyr into a non-person. They know and fear the power of the martyr, even in death. Daniel Ellsberg in 1965 witnessed a 22-year-old anti-war activist, Norman Morrison, douse himself with kerosene and light himself on fire. The flames shot 10 feet into the air outside the office of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara at the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. Ellsberg cited the self-immolation along with the nationwide anti-war protests as one of the factors that led him to release the Pentagon Papers. The radical Catholic priest, Daniel Berrigan, after traveling to North Vietnam with a peace delegation during the war, visited the hospital room of Ronald Brazzi. Brazzi was a high school student who had drenched himself with kerosene and immolated himself outside the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in downtown Syracuse, New York, to protest the war. He was still living a month later, Berrigan writes. I was able to gain access to him. I smelled the odor of burning flesh. I understood anew what I had seen in North Vietnam. The boy was dying in torment. His body was like a great piece of meat cast upon a grill. He died shortly thereafter. I felt that my senses had been invaded in a new way. I had understood the power of death in the modern world. I knew I must speak and act against death, because this boy's death was being multiplied a thousandfold in the land of burning children. So I went to Catonsville because I had gone on to Hanoi. In Catonsville, Maryland, Berrigan and eight other activists, known as the Catonsville Nine, broke into a draft board on May 17, 1968. They took 378 draft files and burned them with homemade napalm in the parking lot. Berrigan was sentenced to 3 years in a federal prison. I was in Prague in 1989 for the Velvet Revolution. I attended the commemoration of the self-immolation of a 20-year-old university student named Jan Palach. Palach had stood on the steps outside the National Theater in Wenceslas Square in 1969, poured petrol over himself, and lit himself on fire. He died of his wounds 3 days later. He left behind a note saying that his act was the only way to protest the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, which had taken place 5 months earlier. His funeral procession was broken up by police. When frequent candlelight vigils were held at his grave at the Osany Cemetery, the communist authorities, determined to stamp out his memory, disinterred his body, cremated it, and handed the ashes to his mother. During the winter of 1989, posters with Pollock's face covered the walls of Prague. His death, 2 decades later, was lionized as the supreme act of resistance against the Soviets and pro-Soviet regime installed after the overthrow of Alexander Dubček. Thousands of people marched to the square of Red Army soldiers and renamed it Jan Palach Square. He won. One day, the street where Bushnell lit himself on fire will bear his name. He will, like Palach, be honored for his moral courage. Palestinians, betrayed by most of the world, already look to him as a hero, and because of him, it will be impossible to demonize all of us. Divine violence terrifies a corrupt and discredited ruling class. It exposes their depravity. It illustrates that not everyone is paralyzed by fear. It is a siren call to battle radical evil. That is what Bushnell intended, and his sacrifice speaks to our better selves. Genocide is the crime of crimes. It is not a political issue. It is a moral issue. Defying genocide and rejecting all complicity with those who commit genocide is a moral imperative. Those of us who are people of faith are called to invert the world's value system. It is not about the practical. It is not about success. It is not even about victory. In fact, we can find victory by way of defeat. It is about standing, no matter the cost, with the oppressed. It is about our faith, our belief that the good draws to it the good, even if all the empirical evidence says otherwise. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. O you who have believed, be persistently standing firm in justice. Witness for Allah, even if it be against yourselves or parents and relatives. Whether one is rich or poor, Allah is more worthy of both. So follow not personal inclination, lest you not be just. And if you distort your testimony or refuse to give it, then indeed Allah is ever of what you do aware. The days ahead will be dark and frightening. But as Immanuel Kant reminded us, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this is our task, to fight, no matter the cost, for justice, to fight, no matter the cost, for the sacred, to fight, no matter the cost, for life, to fight, no matter the cost, to free our Palestinian brothers and sisters from the river to the sea. We may fail, but let those who come after us say we tried. We were true to our call as Muslims, as Christians, and as Jews, that we stood with the oppressed, knowing that when you stand with the oppressed, you are treated like the oppressed. Fenceless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere. Ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair show an affirming flame. I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not know if we can halt this genocide. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I know the forces of death have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time for questions. Does anybody have a question?
The Western politicians use a two-state solution as a cover, while Israel rejects the idea out of hand. One state solution with democracy and equal protection for all of citizens is highly unlikely in the racist Zionist apartheid regime. In your opinion, what will become of millions of Palestinians, and would we in our lifetime see justice?
Well, my father, who was a Presbyterian minister, was in the civil rights movement, and what he was fighting for is exactly what we should be fighting for in historic Palestine, and that's called one person, one vote. Everybody has human rights. I think, as Ilan Papi has pointed out, the hatred, the death, the genocidal violence, while it is being unleashed against the Palestinians, will consume Israel itself. Time, I can't tell. I was a reporter for a long time, and often we knew that the tinder was there, but we didn't know what would strike it. The first intifada would be a good example. What caused the conflagration of the first intifada was a road accident. Those are questions I can't answer. None of us know. What's clear is that there is no hope if we don't resist. So much of this genocide, it's not just about wholesale murder. It's about erasure. The universities, the cultural centers, and targeting the intellectual class, the writers, the poets, the academics. It's about erasure. And, you know, our job is to, the small bit that we can contribute, is to fight against that erasure. But time, I don't know. I don't know.
As you have rightly pointed out, the U.S. is complicit in genocide. Without the U.S. support, this war would end tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we all are in the awkward position of being American citizens and living here and no one listening to us. But let me ask you another question, which is, why are the Arab and Muslim states so silent? They're still engaged in diplomatic ties and economic ties with Israel, whether through the Abraham Accords or not. If they were to simply break their diplomatic ties and impose sanctions on Israel, that would probably have a strong impact. Turkey, for example, President Erdogan is so loudly criticizing Netanyahu every day, but I just discovered it is one of the top 10 trading partners, both import and export, including iron and steel, including arms. So what do you make of that? You have spent a lot of time in the Muslim world, in Gaza and in the Arab countries. Do you see any hope there of a reversal? Thank you.
Well, they're corrupt, despotic regimes. The only people that when all this is, all the history of this is written, the only country in the Arab world that can be written about with any kind of honor or is Yemen. Because the Yemenis know exactly what it feels like. 30,000 Yemenis starved to death under the U.S.-Saudi siege. And they had cholera epidemics. And so they understand fully what's happening in Gaza, and they're resisting. These are dictatorships. I mean, don't get me even started on Egypt with Hala. You know, before the genocide, it cost $350 for a travel exit visa through Hala, which is run, of course, by Sisi's sons. Now it's $5,000 for an adult and $2,500 for a child, and when they feel like it, they'll jack the price up to $10,000. So they're actually profiting off of the genocide. No, these regimes are either sustained or were imposed by Western powers and remain so. See, remember Mubarak, we bought Mubarak off for the first Gulf War. I just came from Egypt. I was invited to go to Doha by Al Jazeera, and I did broadcasts on Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic. And then I went to Rafah. I tried to go to Rafah. The Egyptian Press Syndicate was trying to organize a protest outside of Rafah because they've locked all the foreign journalists out of Gaza. And of course, the Sisi government blocked us. They stopped us. So yeah, no, these regimes are completely complicit in this genocide. I mean, Sisi is a creature of the CIA and the Mossad anyway, so.
One quick question. As we go from city council to ask these mayors to stand for ceasefire, the reaction we get from them is, you guys are asking us too much. Why are you putting us in this difficult situation where you're asking us to be divisive? So in the name of unity, they're saying we are not going to say anything about the ceasefire. The very interesting thing that's happening in these city councils is we have these rabbis that come with their whole congregations. They literally act like a mob, and they speak as Israelis. They don't identify as Americans. They say, you know, I was in the IDF, I was in Israel, this and that. And they're the ones saying, hey, you guys have been elected for local issues. Why are you talking about international issues? So it's like, what do you do with these mayors? And then they come back and they demolish us like kids. Why are you putting us in these situations? What do we do with these things?
So politics is a game of fear. And it's our job to make them afraid. That's the only way they respond. They're not going to respond to our good intentions. I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter. And Ralph ran because he wanted to pull 5, 10, 15 million voters, probably Democrats, into a third party to create pressure on the Democratic Party. I'm not going to tell anyone in this room how to vote, but I would not vote for Joe Biden if you put a gun to my head. So, you know, they have to pay. They have to pay for this. And I don't want Trump, but I didn't support the genocide. I didn't do this. They did it. And it won't stop if they don't pay. That's the bottom line. And we have the numbers to make them pay. I mean, imagine this. I mean, this is a black and white moral issue. And if these council members won't do the minimum, which is oppose genocide, then run other candidates and don't support them.
My question, or maybe your comments on that we are the 4 million Muslims living in US, and almost 1 to 1.3 are only registered. So 3 million Muslims sitting at home, not going and vote, they cast their vote. So what is your recommendation for them to really actively go registered and cast the vote for, rather, you know, depending on who they're voting for, Republican or Democrat? But the first key thing is that we have a power of 4 million votes, and we need to use that so we can send the Muslim candidates in Congress. Based on our population, we should have at least 14, 15 Muslim candidates in Congress and 4 or 5 senators. So please comments on that. Well,
so I ran, you know, Ralph Nader is fluent Arabic speaker. His family's from Lebanon. He's Lebanese Christian. And he's always been good on Palestine. But we could not get Arab support for Ralph. That would have not happened if it was the reverse. The Zionist lobby is unified in a way that the Arab community is not. And I think that's because the Arab world is very diverse. To be an Algerian is not to be an Egyptian. They don't have the kind of cultural uniformity because of their different national backgrounds They also don't have the money. I mean, we live in a system of legalized bribery. Joe Biden has gotten more AIPAC money than any other U.S. senator in history. He is a creature of the credit card companies in Delaware and AIPAC. And you have to remember that they owe their political career to these moneyed interests. Schumer, Pelosi, none of these people would hold political power but for the money of the Israel lobby, Goldman Sachs. And if you destroyed that system of legalized bribery, they would lose their privileged position. And that they will never give up. So unless the system changes, we have to build the kind of moneyed institutions that will back candidates that oppose this endless funding and arming of the Zionist state. But I would also say the most important thing, and here I want to really express my admiration for these young kids who get out in the street and block bridges, and that is so important. And Jewish, and let's not forget our allies, Jewish Voices for Peace. That is so key, and that's why the Democrats are running so scared. And what's amazing about these protests is that not only are they sustained, we're now 6 months into this, but they don't diminish in numbers. So there's a moment in Kissinger's memoirs, please do not buy the book, where there's a huge, I think it's 1971, a gigantic anti-war demonstration, and tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators have surrounded the White House. And in order to protect the White House, they put empty city buses in a ring all the way around the White House. And Nixon is looking out the window, and he says to Kissinger, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. That is exactly where we want people in power to be.
You were just listening to Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us. He spoke in Newark, California in early April 2024. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist who's covered the Middle East for many years. He's the author of many books. His latest is The Greatest Evil is War. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs with Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us, and for his latest book, War is the Greatest Evil, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Palestine Center for Public Policy. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
One in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law & Disorder, Chris Hedges joins us to talk about the need for an independent political action.
What does it take to defend ourselves? Chris Hedges thinks not voting for the Democratic Party.
Bruce Ratner joins us to talk about his new book, Early Detection.
This is a significant contribution to humanity. Just like his older brother Michael Ratner made a significant contribution in the field of constitutional rights, Bruce Ratner has made one in the field of early detection of cancer.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The growing repression and censorship in the United States is manifest daily. Already, some 3,000 students have been arrested, and many of their pro-Palestinian encampments on college campuses have been violently closed down. The so-called paper of record, the New York Times, has instructed reporters not to use the words genocide or ethnic cleansing. Journalist Chris Hedges has been removed from the Real News Network for interviewing Dennis Kucinich, the independent candidate for Congress in Ohio, and for not supporting the presidential candidacy of Joe Biden. The necessity for independent political action, independent of both the Republican and the Democratic parties, is the lesson that many social activists are drawing. Journalist Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report coined the phrase "the more effective of two evils" in describing the Democratic Party. Significant social change comes from organizing people independently. The rise of the CIO, the civil rights movement, and the movement to end the war in Vietnam are illustrations of that truth. In appreciating the role of the Democratic Party, social activists are increasingly concluding that independent political action now will help us during the next presidential administration. We speak today with Chris Hedges, the journalist and author, about the collapsing media landscape and what happened to him at the Real News Network, as well as how we can preserve journalism. Chris spent two decades as a foreign correspondent, serving as the Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, where he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. He's the author of 14 books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, and also The Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, please tell us what the Real News Network is and what happened to you over there.
So the Real News Network is primarily has one funder, T.M. Scruggs. He told, according to the editor-in-chief, Max Alvarez, that if the Real News did anything in his eyes to contribute to the election of Donald Trump, he would pull the funding. That's just an inverted way of saying elect Joe Biden. There's been a certain animus between Scruggs and myself. I had written a column for Shearpost where he had also contributed, where I defended the writer Alice Walker from charges that she was an anti-Semite. He demanded that that column be removed or he would cut his funding. Bob refused to remove the column and the funding was cut. I had posted an interview with Dennis Kucinich, a former Democratic member of the House, former Democratic mayor of Cleveland. He is running for a House seat in Ohio in the current election cycle as an independent. That segment or show was taken down from the Real News site, and then my show was terminated. The reason I was given was that I jeopardized their nonprofit status. There was nothing that I said in that show or any other show.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk more about the attacks on pro-Palestinian protesters with the president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Co-founder and President Salam Al-Mariati joins us to talk about his efforts to hold university officials and law enforcement accountable for allowing attacks against pro-Palestinian protesters.
We'll also speak with graduate student Javier Fitzsimmons-Cruz, who was arrested after the encampment was torn down.
He vividly describes the situation at the NYU encampment, and after all, he ran from his arrest to defend his dissertation.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
As the Israeli-Gaza war rages on, protests have spread throughout American campuses as students oppose Israeli military onslaught and the tragic humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Students have demanded a ceasefire, an end to U.S. military support for Israel, and that universities divest from Israel. In response, university officials have suspended and expelled students, banned pro-Palestinian student groups, called in the police, and sent mixed messages on students' right to free speech. At UCLA, a group of counter-protesters launched a violent attack on pro-Palestinian protesters. To address these critical issues, we've invited Salam Al-Mariati, president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he oversees MPAC's groundbreaking civic engagement, public policy, and advocacy work. Salam Al-Mariati is an expert on Islam in the West, Muslim reform movements, human rights, democracy, national security, and Middle East politics. He's spoken at the White House and on Capitol Hill and has represented the U.S. at international human rights and religious freedom conferences. He's very active in interfaith dialogue, which is where I first met him in the wake of 9/11 in my capacity as a leader of interfaith communities united for justice and peace. Salam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you, Stephen. Always good to hear from you.
What's happened at UCLA has gained national attention. On May 3rd, your organization, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, sent a letter to the Department of Education and its Office for Civil Rights calling for an investigation into the violent April 30 attacks on pro-Palestinian student protesters at UCLA by pro-Zionist agitators. In response, the Office of Civil Rights promptly initiated an official investigation into the incident under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Salam, please describe those attacks for our listeners and tell us what's the current status of the investigation.
Sure. I'd also like to first describe the context of the encampments themselves. I attended four of them, Vanderbilt, George Washington, UCLA, and USC. All of them were peaceful. In fact, a recent study from a center at Princeton said that of the 3,700 encampments established throughout the country on universities' property, 95% had been considered peaceful. So, yes, there was a handful of incidents, I'm sure, where there was some harassment, some intimidation, some vandalism, maybe breaking a window here or there. But when the issue of the Vietnam War and the protests took place there, the civil rights protests on campuses, I met with Eric Holder, the former attorney general, and he told me he occupied a building when he was a college